This serpent is the Lord creator of the universe. The serpent is the animal symbolic of that power which transcends death. The serpent can shed its skin and be, as it were, reborn. The serpent is a fluent animal and suggests water and lives in swampy places, but its wonderful little flashing fire tongue suggests the fire in the water. The libation, the wine, the intoxicant is water with fire in it. All water has fire in it. That's why it fertilizes trees and so forth. The serpent is the Lord of the spirit in life, bound in life. It is a fundamental figure, and this is the role it plays in practically all the mythologies of the world. And the serpent is androgyne in its male-female, in its primary aspect, and it splits into two. And sometimes the serpent can assume a human form. Now, I don't know whether you've seen very much of Hindu, Indian art, or Japanese art, but particularly Hindu art and Ceylonese art, they're these wonderfully graceful serpent kings. Beautiful youths. Perhaps you wondered about Eve being attracted by the serpent. Well, just go to India or get a book of Indian art and look at those boys. They have these wonderful hoods of five or seven cobra heads to show what they really could do if they wanted to be animals again. And they hold in one hand a jar of the elixir of immortality, and in the other hand, the staff of that tree, a branch of that tree, exactly what was offered to Eve. Now, when you go to a Buddhist temple, let's say the wonderful temple of the Daibutsu, the big Buddha in Nara, as you approach that temple, there's a great gate. And this gate is guarded by two heroic-looking, threatening figures. These are the cherubim guarding the gate to the tree. And who sits under the tree? The Buddha. And the Buddha's hand is up and saying, "Don't be afraid of those two. Come on in." Now, this is the opposite invitation from that of chapter 2 of the book of Genesis. That is to say, go past these two cherubim. Now, what do those two cherubim signify in the Buddhist tradition? If you look at them carefully, you'll see one has his mouth open, the other his mouth closed. In the Indian tradition, the original being of beings was without thought, just will. Then that being had a thought, and the thought was I. And as soon as it thought I, it became filled with fear that I should be eliminated or killed. And then it had a thought. The thought was, well, since there's nobody else in the universe, what am I afraid of? That's the first thought in the world. It's not very complicated, but it was enough to get rid of the fear. But as soon as the fear was gone, then had desire, the desire that there should be someone else in the world. So fear and desire are the two immediate consequences of I, of thinking I, defending I. And then it split in half, just as Adam was split in half, but in this case it's the divine power itself that splits in half and becomes the male and female that generate the world. There's a little difference in the point of view here. The divine power itself splits in the biblical tradition. The creature is split. The creatures are of that divine power there, but we won't worry about that. Now we're being asked to go back to the unitary experience of immortal life again, and in order to do that, you have to eliminate I. These two men, as long as you have desire and fear of them, desire for your life and its continuity, and fear lest it be taken for you, from you, you can't go through to the tree of life. In other words, in this rendition of the same garden with the same tree of immortal life, we have a totally psychological interpretation of the situation. All that is keeping you out of the garden is your own psychology. Just learn to transcend the ego system and you will find that your ego evaporates and that you are one with that eternal life which lives in you all the time. Now, here are two totally different points of view with respect to the symbol of the tree in the middle of the garden, the serpent guardian of the tree, who is the Lord of eternal life and tells you where it is, one psychological in the Orient, and the other what I would call pedagogical. Father says don't, and you do, and Father is angry, and then Father has to be appeased. Let's say this system is in a theological personified form and pseudo-historical. This one is purely psychological. They are the same symbols. They come from the same beginning, namely the old Sumerian tree. These are two inflections of it, one in the Western and the other in the Oriental worlds. Now, to say something more about the interpretation of symbolic forms. These are the same symbolic forms, and we've already given them three interpretations. I want to say something about that tree in relation to yoga. That tree, in relation to the yogic systems, is identified with your spine. Your spine is the central axis of your own microcosm, your own psyche, just as the pole star and the polar axis of the universe is the axis of the whole cosmos. This spine has seven centers on the way up from its root to the crown of your head. Do you remember? The Sumerian pole had the serpent crossing it seven times. The energy of the psyche, the spiritual energy of the psyche, is called the serpent power. And it is within you, according to this system. Now, I thought it would be interesting tonight just to have me explain to you those seven centers on the way up, and how the whole interpretation of the symbology of life and the tree is changed with each center as you go up. And then we can turn to some psychological theories today about this tree and the serpent and all, and bring this whole thing to a very modern conclusion. I wouldn't like it not to be absolutely up to date, and I've been preparing for this now for some years. The seven centers are called lotuses or padmas, and also called circles or chakras or wheels. And at each of them, on the way up the spine, the whole psyche becomes transformed as the energy rises. Well, now you've all seen pictures of yogis, and you know all about those positions. The lotus position, and so forth. You also know about breath control. The notion is that when your emotions change, so does your breathing. Well, to change your emotions, perhaps regulate your breath, and you'll get in control of yourself. So there is this breath control system. It's a little bit complicated. Just for example, you breathe in through your left nostril to a certain number of counts, imagining the breath is going right down through the spine, clearing its channels, holding the breath for a certain number of counts, and then breathe out through the right nostril, imagining the breath going out the other way, then in through the right, out through the left. Not too easy. And one's advised not to do it without an instructor. I don't see how you could do it without an instructor. And finally, you get the whole channels cleared and your mind settled, and you begin to feel this serpent, the kundalini, the coiled serpent at the base of the spine, begin to move. Now, the thing is to bring it up.